It's a humid July night in 1927 Milwaukee. The air hangs thick over the silent warehouse district as the midnight hour approaches. The low growl of a Model T engine slices through the stillness. Three black sedans edge cautiously around the corner, headlights piercing the inky black night. They come to an abrupt halt in the alley behind Miller's Packing Company. Doors fly open and men pile out. The gang leader barks orders as the sounds of wooden crates and grunting men fill the air. His gravelly voice cuts through the commotion as the crew scrambles to load the truck with their illicit contraband. Crates upon crates of golden yellow bricks. Suddenly, the whine of sirens pierces the air, growing increasingly closer. The police truck careens wildly into the alley, screeching to a stop. This is the police. Drop the margarine and come out with your hands up. Keep listening as we slather on the drama by delving into the sordid world of margarine. Yes, margarine. And the lengths that people would go to get this dastardly dairy alternative. Welcome to As We Eat, where we explore the intersection of food, family, history, and culture.
We think there's something magical that happens when people get together and share food. Conversations seem to happen a little more naturally. We talk about our commonalities and our differences. We share stories, memories, and recipes.
And we'll use food to take a journey that explores our human experience. Share some fun facts and some that aren't so fun. Talk about food history and how food connects and defines us.
So if you've ever eaten, prepared, or shared food, then this podcast probably has something for you.
Hi, Lay. Hey, Kim, how are you?
I'm full of mirth and mayhem today. How are you?
Well, I'm not sure how to follow up with that one. I'm doing good. Doing good. We're fully in spring here. Eric is his last day on the mountain for winter was yesterday, so he's got a couple of weeks off. So we're going to get some projects done around the tiny house, and then he'll go back to the mountain and start building bike trails.
Oh, that's fantastic. He does such a great service for Montana, for the country. I really appreciate all that work that he does. It's so nice to be able to go outside. I think I'm feeling all the spring feelings right now. My cherry tree in my yard is in full bloom, and there's that certain warmth in the air and makes you want to be outside. And then you step outside and you realize you still need a jacket, but that's okay because you've got the light one. And so you pull that out and you just get going, strap up your tennies and go for a walk. So feeling all the good feelings for the season.
Yes. Nice. I love that. I love that. We're rotating out winter to spring clothes. So yeah, that feels great. And like you said, go outside and It has that coldness, but it's not the winter cold up here.
Yeah.
So
it's the potential that you're going to have an amazing day.
Yes.
I think that's what I love the most about spring. Yeah.
Yes, I love that. Speaking of potential, the episode opening is rooted in historical fact with a little bit of creative license added. Margarine did, in fact, create a war between the dairy industry, margarine factories, and the American public. Now, as with so many substitutes and alternatives, margarine saw its origins as a cheap replacement specifically to butter. It's the mid-1800s, and France had gone through a revolution, and Prussia and Spain are threatening the borders. Now, you would think that the Emperor of France, Louis Napoleon III, Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew, would be thinking about the armory, which he probably did. But he also had to feed his troops as well as France's poor laborers. So he did what any good emperor would do, and he announced a contest. A contest with a fairly substantial prize to the first person who could find a replacement for butter. They do have a penchant for butter over there. It was a French chemist by the name of Hippolyte Mesmériez who won the prize with his spread oleomargarine, which takes its name from the Latin word for oil, oleum, and Greek marguerite, meaning pearl, because of the pearlescence luster. Now here's a fun margarine food fact. Mesmériez sold the patent for margarine to a Dutch butter company that ultimately became Unilever. Sadly, outside of winning the prize from the French emperor, he never profited from his discovery. Can you imagine? His family would have been set for life. People,
seriously.
People, always hold on to the patent for your amazing food replacement innovations. And if you sell them, make sure you have a good lawyer or solicitor. Now, back to margarine, which was introduced to the U.S. in 1870, and within 10 years, there were 37 manufacturers of this butter replacement. Now, for reference, there were 39 million people, according to the U.S. Census in 1870, compared to today's population of 334 million. And currently, we have 34 manufacturers of margarine. It was a big industry to have 37 manufacturers at this time.
That's really fascinating.
Right?
Yeah. Sorry. I'm like doing the math in my head now and I'm thinking, gosh, like right. 10 times the people, same level of production.
Right. Yeah. It was very popular during this time. Now, as you can imagine, it also had its fair share of opponents. The dairy industry, of course, was a huge opponent to this. And they proclaimed that margarine threatened, I love this, not only the family farm, okay, I can buy that, but the American way of life and moral order. Arguments by opponents stated that butter should come from the dairy, not the slaughterhouse. During this time, it was produced with beef tallow. So butter should come from the dairy and not the slaughterhouse. Senator Joseph Quarles of Wisconsin, a very dairy state, passionately declared that he wanted butter that has the aroma of life and health, and that he declined to accept as a substitute caul fat matured under the chill of death, blended with vegetable oils and flavored by chemical tricks.
Ew.
I mean, that's quite a statement.
That sure is. Yeah, that's okay. I'm with him so far.
Yep. Now, the opponents of margarine even went so far as to quote dubious scientific reports that there was the possibility that margarine could lead to insanity.
Wow.
Yeah. This was a time when the purity of food was really coming into question. And it's because we saw this turn from homemade and homegrown foods to being commercially manufactured, thanks to the Industrial Revolution. It was actually this desire for purity that helped margarine to gain a stronghold, not because it was viewed as pure, but because the quality of butter had been so drastically compromised at this time that margarine was a substitute that looked pretty good. Though the looks were pretty off-putting. Where we have seen before, and we've talked about this, that food that was white was viewed as pure and even luxury, think white flour, white sugar. This wasn't the case for margarine. It was seen as pale. It was poor man's food and not something that you in good conscience would feed to your family or guests. And the health of your family was very important to the homemaker at this point. It still is, but it was very important at this time.
It was huge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tinting it to make it look like butter, adding slogans like made in the Milky Way or churned especially for lovers of good butter. Now you have a consistent tasting economic spread that people want to purchase. And purchase they did. By 1902, over 125 million pounds of margarine were being produced. But this wasn't without a derisive backlash by the dairy industry. As I mentioned before, they tried smear campaigns calling into question not only individual health, but also the health of the nation. Many states, especially dairy states, passed laws regulating margarine. But the laws were hard to enforce without federal oversight, so the dairy industry took the fight to the hill, demanding the federal government step in. And in 1886, the Oleomargarine Act was signed into law by President Grover Cleveland. It required a hefty tax to be imposed on margarine, 2 cents per pound, which equates to about 67 cents today. And one of the supporters of the law actually stated, I love this, one of the supporters of the law actually stated that he didn't care if the law resulted in increased revenue for state or federal government, but rather intended that the tax be so cumbersome that it actually put the margarine industry out of business. At least he was honest about it, I guess.
An honest politician. We found the first one.
Oh, no. Right. And then in 1902, the Grout Bill was passed, imposing a 10 cents tax to be collected on all colored margarine. Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Ohio actually banned the sale of margarine in 1902.
I had no idea. I mean, but look at all the states. That makes sense with the, I mean, they are what we think of as like the dairy belt.
Right. There were even states that passed laws that required margarine to be dyed pink rather than yellow. But the Supreme Court squashed this quickly, as you can't enforce a law that breaks a law, because adding any coloring to food is essentially food adulteration, which is interesting when you think about all the food that we consume today that is colored, and we're okay with that. The way that they got around this was the margarine manufacturers added a yellow coloring packet that consumers actually massaged into margarine. And my mother remembered this very distinctly when we were talking about this years ago. They would fight over who got to massage the yellow packet into the margarine.
See, so what blows my mind about this right now is because we grew up at a time when color customization was such a huge thing in the home that you could have blue toilet paper, you could have pink toilets, you could have avocado green refrigerators, anything you wanted. And we actually kind of touched on this in our Fire and Ice episode too, about the idea of the set home kitchen.
Yeah.
And clearly this was a known acceptable thing that you're adding a food coloring yourself to your product. Obviously, you could just toss out the coloring if you really wanted to. But why? It kind of boggles my mind that they wouldn't have pink and green and blue and all these different colors that you could have, you know, your fashion colors on your plate. So it just kind of shows how much has really changed for us when it comes to food, and yet not so much as well. Fascinating.
Right. So again, these packets were added so that they could eliminate this grout bill tax.
Right.
They counterfeited stamp tax documents, enabling unlawful distribution of untaxed margarine. You had these documents that had a stamp on it that indicated that you had paid that 10 cent tax on every pound.
Wow.
Yeah. This is where we return to our historical fiction dramatization at the top of the episode. The margarine laws created an environment rife for bootlegging. And this was the beginning of bootlegging. This is where our prohibition bootleggers got their training.
Yeah.
We might should have learned from history here, but whatever. And it wasn't just Yellow Stick Vic Moretti who was carrying these illicit golden bars across state lines. Housewives and their furtive accomplices would travel to states with less restrictive margarine laws and carry pounds of the buttery-ish spread home.
Wow.
Yeah, and fines for this, for breaking these laws, were not insubstantial. In some states, these carriers of colored contraband faced fines of $6,000 and prison terms. Alongside famous felons like Machine Gun Kelly were Joseph Murth and his brother Tony, convicted for illegal oleomargarine commerce, John L. McMonagall for oleo violations, and Charles Willie, imprisoned for crimes against butter. And even with all of these regulations, laws, and opposition, margarine didn't lose its market share. Between 1920 and 1950, margarine sales quadrupled, while butter sales declined by a third. Margarine replaced butter as an economic substitute during the Great Depression. Rationing of World War II gave margarine another boost. And as cookbooks helping homemakers make ends meet started adding margarine as an ingredient, the poor man's food lost much of its stigma. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt even promoted Good Luck Margarine in a TV commercial, stating that she spread it on her toast every morning. And we will actually put this in the show notes because it's
fantastic.
Yes, it's fantastic. So, you know, the next time you recoil at a recipe calling for margarine, consider how this contemporary staple was previously a black market delicacy that inspired many to brazenly flout the law under threat of fines and imprisonment. We're going to take a quick sponsor break, and when we come back, Kim has an interesting tale about a major legal decision that affects the quality of the food that we have in our pantries today. Spring is coming, and that means that there will soon be crops of fresh and tender vegetables to perk up our winter palates. If, like me, you find yourself craving some novelty, then Kim and I heartily recommend the delicious artisan oils and vinegars, salts and spices, chocolates and conserves, and gifts at Genesis Kitchen. Genesis Kitchen is committed to helping the foodie community find a wide variety of ethically and sustainably sourced food and pantry items. My favorite is the Barnacle Kelp Chili Crisp, and Kim won't stop talking about Teeny Tiny's organic curry spice blends. And if you're looking to share a little food love with someone special, there are a variety of gift sets that Genesis Kitchen has especially curated to whet the appetite. If you're local to the Flathead Valley, visit them at their Columbia Falls location. If not, they're just a click away at genesis-kitchen.com. This episode is sponsored by Genesis Kitchen. Use the code ASWEEAT25 to enjoy 25% off your first order. Promotion ends April 30th, 2024.
Leigh, you know that I find these legal cases involving food to be absolutely fascinating.
Yes, I do.
The first one I learned about and shared with our As We Eat family dates to episode 46, By Jam, Jelly, or Conserve, The True Stories of Fruit Spreads, when we talked about the seminal 1911 legal case of, quote, 62 cases, more or less, each containing 6 jars of jam et al. V. United States, end quote, which set legal precedent not only for how much fruit pectin versus juice constitutes jam, but was a link in a series of legal cases that clearly positions the U.S. legal system as the final word on limitations on what is and is not food via the system of taxation, because you have to know what something is before you can tax it.
I just want to interrupt real quickly, because one of the things that the Oleomargarine Act did was also defined what butter was so that they could actually tax margarine, because the only things at that point that were food that were taxed were alcohol and tobacco. Not that tobacco's food, but those were the only two things that could be taxed. So this defining of something, it was really important.
Yeah, because if it's something else, you can say, you can't tax me for margarine. I'm actually producing, you know, pardrin, whatever. And then you get around the tax, or you falsify your tax documents, as you've said. But that is the whole point of that 62 cases, was to give a definition so that it could be taxed, because things were being imported at that point, a great deal from Europe, especially jams, jellies, and preserves. And so this was an opportunity for the U.S. government to recoup some money on food coming into the U.S., but you had to know what it was before you could tax it. Right. And this makes complete sense with margarine versus butter, because by its ingredients, one is much more costly to make. Dairy fat is going to be a lot more than vegetable oil, and the government always wants its pound of flesh, pun fully intended. And to my great and utter delight, see what I did there, I found another trailblazing Supreme Court case that, while not actually connected to margarine, does shed some light on another component of food adulteration law, protecting the consumer's right to knowledge. And that involved the process of making apple cider vinegar. But before I get to that, during the turn of the 20th century, intense industrialization of food production led to an increase in the availability of processed foods and multiple issues related to food adulteration and mislabeling. You talked about this in when we were talking about margarine. Many products were being misrepresented to consumers, either through intentional deception or just a lack of regulatory oversight. In response to these concerns, the U.S. Pure Food and Drug Act was passed in 1906. This landmark legislation aimed to protect consumers from harmful and misleading products by regulating the labeling and the purity of food and drugs. The act required accurate labeling of food products and prohibited the sales of adulterated or misbranded goods. In the realm of U.S. federal law, the concept of adulterated and misbranded food carries significant weight, with the truly lovely and acceptable premise to safeguard consumers against potentially harmful or deceitful products. The legal definition of adulterated food, as outlined in Article 21 of the U.S. Code, Section 342, encompasses a range of criteria aimed at ensuring the purity and safety of consumables. This definition includes food containing poisonous substances, those with omitted or substituted constituents, as well as items tainted by unsafe color additives or non-nutritive substances. To put it all very simply, if a food product becomes contaminated or unsafe during its manufacturing journey, it falls within the purview of adulterated food. And this goes straight back to what we're talking about with the additive of food coloring, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what's in your food coloring, it effectively means that the product has been adulterated. Similarly, the legal definition of misbranded food, as delineated in Article 21 of U.S. Code Section 343, prohibits products that deceive or fail to provide essential information to consumers. Misbranded foods encompass various infractions, including misleading packaging or labeling, omission of required information, such as manufacturer details and nutritional content, and failure to disclose the presence of color additives or pesticide chemicals. Moreover, any food products making nutrition or health-related claims must adhere to stringent labeling requirements to ensure accuracy and transparency. In short, the legal framework served as pillars of consumer protection, ensuring that what we eat is not only safe, but is also truthfully represented that it is what it says it is. This is true of early instances of oleomargarine, and it was true of a legal case from 1908 known as, quote, United States versus 95 barrels, more or less, of alleged apple cider vinegar, end quote. I love these case names. They give me life. They are my favorite things. A case of 95 barrels of alleged apple cider vinegar arose from allegations that a certain quantity of liquid claiming to be apple cider vinegar did not meet the standards set forth by the Pure Food and Drug Act. The U.S. government brought the lawsuit against the barrels of alleged vinegar, arguing that they did not comply with the legal definition of apple cider vinegar as specified by the act. The case involved extensive analysis and expert testimony to determine the authenticity of the liquid in question. It ultimately culminated in a legal battle that tested the boundaries of food regulation and consumer protection in the United States. Now, I know we've touched on vinegar a bit in our What's in Your Pantry episode about cake flour and vinegar, but I have menopausal brain fog, so we're going through the procedure briefly to explain why the apple cider vinegar case was such a big deal. So, in its first stage, apples are crushed to extract juice, then filtered and placed in a fermentation vessel. Yeast is added to kickstart fermentation, converting natural sugars in the juice into alcohol. After alcohol fermentation, bacteria oxidize the alcohol into acetic acid over several weeks to months. This process gives vinegar its tangy flavor and aroma. So there you have it, apple cider vinegar distillation in a real nutshell. Back to the issue of the 95 barrels case, was that Douglas Packing Company, the manufacturer, stated on the label that the vinegar was crafted from selected apples, when in truth, the vinegar was produced using dehydrated fresh apples and later rehydrated with pure water to create the vinegar. So basically, the apple slices got a bath, and that's what was being used to make vinegar. Fascinating bit is that neither party contended that this significantly altered the vinegar's quality. Aside from the variance in apple types, manufacturing procedures remained consistent, and upon sampling the vinegar in question alongside apple cider vinegar derived from fresh apples, the trial judge observed only minimal disparities in appearance and flavor. Chemical analysis also revealed comparable compositions for both liquids. You basically had apple cider vinegar versus apple cider vinegar. But the court's decision fell on three key factors. First, vinegar from dried apples differed from the conventional understanding of vinegar made from fresh ingredients. Second, while fresh apples naturally contain the juice typically used in apple cider vinegar production, Douglas Packing substituted water. And lastly, the label's assertion of made from selected apples falsely implied the use of fresh apples rather than dried ones. All these issues were deemed violations under the Pure Food and Drug Act's misbranded section. The court ruling in favor of the United States underscored the importance of accurate labeling and adherence to regulatory standards in the food industry, and served as a precedent for future efforts to ensure the integrity of food products and protect consumers from deceptive practices. So whether it's margarine, vinegar, or jam, we are protected from the potential vagaries of adulterated and misbranded foods. And even though these legal cases might sound old-fashioned, the specter of tainted food still lives with us today as we face new frontiers in agricultural science, culinary espionage, and corporate sabotage, all of which we're going to be talking about in the next few episodes.
You know, I roll my eyes a lot at the Food and Drug Administration and some of the things that we see that they have to uphold. But the further and further that we get into our season, I can absolutely understand why we have the laws that we have, and I can appreciate them a little bit more. Sometimes I still will roll my eyes, but I do appreciate the fact that we do have this protection against adulteration, culinary espionage.
And it's also fascinating that it happens at a federal level and not at a state level. But the margarine case actually bears this out because you could bring product in from another state that was not so prohibitive about the production of something, which then absolutely and completely undermines having it at a state level anyway. If it weren't for these federal protections, we could easily be eating a lot of stuff that says that it's one thing and it's actually not. And maybe to our health detriment, if a product didn't list that it contained nuts, peanuts, to which so many people now have allergies, it's literal potluck and not in the fun way in terms of whether you're going to have an anaphylactic reaction or not.
Right.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of episodes.
I sure did. I mentioned our Fire and Ice episode where we talked about the effective invention and commercialization of ovens and refrigerators in our kitchens. I talked about jams, jellies, and conserves, which was a reader-requested episode, actually.
That's right.
And I also briefly touched on one of our What's in Your Pantry episodes, where we had talked about cake flour and vinegar, especially.
We have a couple of more episodes. Episode 5, Butter, Rebellion, Sculptures, and Pagan Offerings, which in it, you actually discussed a butter rebellion because of the quality of butter. And in episode 29, we also talked about the origins of margarine in kitchen technologies, canning, can openers, and cookie cutters.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of episodes out there that have some more interesting information about not only margarine, but some of the rules and laws that we see.
Yeah, it's fun stuff. I can't wait to explore more of it. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We are both so excited to bring you some of these fascinating stories at the intersection of food and crime and how our laws help protect us from eating things that maybe we shouldn't. For more information about today's episode, check out our website at aswe-eat.com. Please follow us on Instagram at aswe-eat and join our family recipes, traditions, and food lore community on Facebook. I want to hear about your favorite margarine recipes. Please.
And so you don't miss an episode, subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And before you jump into that sedan and head for the abandoned alleyway, if you could rate the podcast on Apple Podcast, Podchaser, or Spotify, we would be ever so appreciative. It really helps us achieve our desire for podcast domination.
That's fantastic. We also publish the As We Eat Journal on Substack. We would be so honored if you would support us by becoming a subscriber. We take tasty trips through discoveries, table talks, food and art, vintage recipes, and so much more. We're sure you'll find one that's perfect for you at asweeat.substack.com.
You've been listening to the As We Eat podcast, part of our curiosity-driven project, Serving Up How Food Connects, Defines, and Inspires, by blending a bit of research with a dash of humor, sometimes a stick of margarine, but a whole lot of passion.
So much passion. Ooh.